Jefferson that his intention was to give a lesson to the Indians who may visit the museum, and also to show my sentiments respecting wars. He had Lewis dressed in an elegant Indian robe made of 140 ermine skins, given to Lewis by Cameawait. Peel was tremendously excited by the specimens. "I have animals brought from the seacoast," he exulted to Philadelphia musician John Hawkins in a May 5th letter. "Also some parts of the dress, etc., of the natives of Columbia River, and have animals totally unknown." In 1807, Lewis attended three meetings of the American Philosophical Society, April 17th, June 19th, and July 17th, where it can be assumed he was the center of attention, bombarded with questions from the leading scientific figures of the day. Most of all, they wanted to know publication plans. "It is a work that seems to excite much attention," Peel told Hawkins, "and will, I hope, have a great sale and give considerable profit to this bold adventurer." To help ensure that hoped-for success, Lewis got other artists involved. John James Barillet was a 60-year-old Irish-born engraver. On July 14th, Lewis paid him $40 for two drawings of waterfalls. He engaged the well-known 37-year-old French-born portrait painter, Sam Memmott, to do drawings of the Osage and Mandan Indians who had come east with him at a cost of $83.50. Sam Memmott also painted Lewis's portrait. Alexander Wilson was a 31-year-old Scottish-born artist naturalist, best known today for his beautifully illustrated, multi-volumed American Ornithology. In that work, Wilson wrote, "It was the request and particular wish of Captain Lewis made to me in person that I make drawings of each of the feathered tribe as had been preserved and were new." Among others from the expedition, the set includes Wilson's painting of Lewis's woodpecker. Lewis had a journal stuffed with figures. The measurements of the passage of the moon past the stars, taken at every opportunity along the voyage. They had cost him much lost sleep and considerable frustration when clouds obscured the moon. But with the figures, an expert could establish the longitude of the place where they were made. Ferdinand Hassler, a 37-year-old Swiss-born mathematician, was the ideal man for the job. He had just been appointed instructor of mathematics at West Point, but before leaving Philadelphia, Lewis engaged him to make the calculations. He advanced Hassler $100 on May 3rd. Before Clark left for St. Louis in March 1807, the captains had made an oral agreement to split the costs involved in preparing the work. They had also agreed to purchase Sergeant Ordway's journal from him at a price of $300, presumably with the objective of forestalling yet another rival and to incorporate Ordway's writing into their book. On April 18th, Lewis paid Ordway a $150 advance. By July, Lewis had signed up botanists, ornithologists, naturalists, artists, mathematicians, zoologists, and others to help make his work as good as it could possibly be. He had done everything he could to hurry along the publication process, except one thing. He had not hired an editor. This is inexplicable. He knew Conrad could not simply set type from the journals as they stood. In the first place, there was the daunting task of separating out the scientific material from the narrative flow. Then there was the need to incorporate Ordway's journal. In addition, there was the pressing necessity of correcting the spellings and grammar. Lewis had neither the skills nor the time to do these jobs himself. He was being pressed on an almost daily basis by Conrad to start turning in manuscript. At the American Philosophical Society and around Philadelphia, the question he most often heard was, "When do we get to see the book?" He knew that Jefferson greatly desired as early a publication as possible. He had sufficient funds to hire the work done. Yet, as far as is known, he made no effort whatsoever to find an editor, and he prepared not a single line himself. Lewis spent considerable time on paperwork. Scarcely had he arrived in Philadelphia when the accountant of the War Department, one William Simmons, began to pester him about the many drafts on the government Lewis had signed. The drafts were coming in for payment, and Simmons wanted more information about them. On June 17th, in one of his letters, Simmons wrote the heart-stopping lines, You will therefore do well to bring with you, back to Washington, any papers or documents which may relate to your expenditures on the expedition, so as to explain such of the charges as may require it. As one example, Lewis had presented no receipts for the rations or the clothing account for the men. I mention this item as the most prominent one, but others may also require proof. The total number of drafts involved ran to 1,989 items. Like any public servant who has his expense account questioned by the government, Lewis was going to find it somewhere between difficult and impossible to come up with all the receipts. Still, he worked at the task, both in Philadelphia and later back in Washington. By early August, he had a final summation ready. It came to $38,722.25. For many of the drafts, the government was simply going to have to take Lewis's word for it. One charming example went back to March 1806, when Lewis had traded his uniform coat, but little worn, to the Clatsops for a canoe. Of course, no receipt existed. Lewis listed it this way: one uniform laced coat, one silver epaulette, one dirk and belt, one hanger and belt, one pistol and one fowling piece, all private property, given in exchange for canoe, horses, etc., for public service during the expedition, $135. It is easy to sympathize with Lewis over this bureaucratic harassment, but he really was playing fast and loose with the government during this time. Though living in Philadelphia, engaged in what was essentially a private enterprise, he was governor of Louisiana. Beyond writing one letter to Secretary Bates asking information about conditions in St. Louis, he had done absolutely nothing on his job. Yet on June 28th, he presented Secretary of State James Madison with a bill for his salary from March 3rd to June 30th, totaling $666.66. "You would much oblige me," he wrote Madison, "by forwarding a check on the Bank of the United States for the amount as early as it may be convenient." The State Department, which ran territorial affairs, deducted $5.55 as an overcharge and paid the remainder. Jefferson, meanwhile, was torn. He wanted Lewis to get the book out, but he was beginning to have cause to regret appointing him governor, for there was turmoil in St. Louis. More Americans arrived daily, creating squabbles over deeds of land, trading licenses, Indian rights, and the other usual items of contention on the frontier. A firm hand was needed. On June 4th, the president had written Lewis a chatty letter: "Your mother returned from Georgia in good health a little before I left Monticello," signing off with "friendly salutations and assurances of constant affection and respect." But in an August 8th letter, written from Monticello, the president expressed a certain anxiety as to when Lewis was going to go to St. Louis to take up his responsibilities. He wanted Lewis to get started on "the restoration of that harmony in the territory so essential to its happiness and so much desired by me," and indicated that he expected Lewis to be now proceeding to take up his post. In his June letter, the president had the painful task of informing Lewis that he had sent 25 boxes of artifacts brought back from the West via a ship from Washington to Richmond, but the ship had been stranded and everything was lost save some horns. Probably the moose and wapiti horns now hanging at Monticello. Lewis, in reply, said he sincerely regretted the loss and commented in what could be read as an implied criticism of Jefferson's lack of care of the priceless artifacts: "It seems peculiarly unfortunate that those, at least, which had passed the continent of America, and after their exposure to so many casualties and risks, should have met such destiny in their passage through a small portion only of the Chesapeake." Lewis was leading a very heady life. At 33, he was the most celebrated man in Philadelphia, a city world-renowned for its celebrated men. He was the protege of the president. Balls and testimonials were held in his honor, the biggest in the nation's capital. He had been generously rewarded by Congress, praised by the leading scientists of the day, appointed governor of the biggest territory of the United States, and was the center of attention wherever he went. His prospects could hardly have been better. It was, perhaps, too much success too early in life. There were, perhaps, too many balls with too many toasts. Public drunkenness was so commonplace in early 19th century America that it was seldom commented upon. Certainly, no one would have objected to the young hero celebrating his triumph. Still, he was doing a lot of heavy drinking. On April 20th, he entered into his account book a payment of $5 to his landlady, Mrs. Wood, for a dozen of porter. On May 5th, it was $10 for a dozen of ale. More telling, he was out on the town almost every night. His companion was Malin Dickerson, whom he had first met in 1802. Dickerson, a 37-year-old lawyer and bachelor who moved in the highest social circles in Philadelphia, later served as governor of New Jersey, senator from New Jersey, and secretary of the Navy in President Andrew Jackson's second term. His diary records numerous evenings spent with Lewis in the spring and early summer of 1807. They dined out regularly and often went for walks around the center square, today's Penn Square, a popular park and parade ground. On July 2nd, Dickerson noted in his diary, "Rode out with Captain Lewis to the Marshalls. Spent the day very pleasantly in eating, drinking, and shooting at the trees." On the 4th of July, "Dined with a large party at Fouquet's. Delivered a flaming speech to them. Kept myself very sober. Went to the play at evening, the house very uproarious." That same day, Lewis also attended a dinner party given by the Society of the Friends of the People at the Spring Garden Tavern. To the 160 guests, he proposed a political toast. "May the man who has by profession and act proved his sincere attachment for peace never quit our national helm at a crisis like this." The crisis was with the British, who had attacked and seized the U.S. frigate Chesapeake off the Virginia Capes on June 22nd. Jefferson's policy was to avoid war if at all possible, while imposing an embargo on Britain. On July 7th, Lewis and Dickerson walked till 11 at night. These walks were a regular thing with them. It seems likely that they frequented taverns as they moved along. On July 18th, Dickerson recorded that they went out together and saw a fight in which a knife was flashed and a man's face cut, which certainly sounds like a barroom brawl. Jefferson later wrote of the habit into which he, Lewis, had fallen, and the painful reflections that would necessarily produce in a mind like his. It seems that Lewis's high-mindedness caused him to curse himself every morning, and possibly to swear off drinking, only to go back to another ball or for another walk with Dickerson that night. Lewis had problems beyond coping with his celebrity status and his drinking. His friend Clark had found a wife. Lewis wanted one. That fall, he wrote Dickerson in a bantering tone, recalling some of his adventures with the girls during the summer. He said he was trying to think of those bewitching gypsies as a secondary consideration, but admitted that Miss E. Blank B. Blank Y. of Philadelphia will still remain provokingly important in spite of all my philosophy. Then he fired off a series of questions that had all the marks of coming from a man in love. "Have you heard from her? Have you seen her? How is she? Is she well, sick, dead, or married?" Whatever the answers, quite clearly he had failed in his courtship. He went on, "I am now a perfect widower with respect to love. I feel all that restlessness, that inquietude, that certain indescribable something common to old bachelors, which I cannot avoid thinking, my dear fellow, proceeds from that void in our hearts, which might or ought to be better filled. Whence it comes, I know not, but certain it is that I never felt less like a hero than at the present moment. What may be my next adventure, God knows, but on this I am determined, to get a wife." Meriwether Lewis was a man who usually got what he was determined to get. Chapter 34. Virginia. August 1806 to March 1807. Sometime in late July, Lewis journeyed to Washington, where he turned in his records and receipts to Mr. Simmons in the War Department. He then went to Locust Hill and Ivy to be with his family. He took the journals with him. In August, he visited Jefferson at Monticello. In September, he traveled to Richmond, where he was an observer of Burr's treason trial, perhaps at Jefferson's request, with the duty of writing a report. No Lewis report is known to exist, however, and Jefferson was scrupulous in saving his correspondence. Back in Ivy, Lewis saw to family business, primarily land speculation in the Ohio Valley. Before setting out for the Pacific in 1803, he had urged his mother to make certain his half-brother, John Marks, got an education. In 1807, he took charge of young Marks's professional training. He arranged for Marks to go to Philadelphia to attend medical lectures, with letters of introduction to the various savants in town. He told Marks to call on Dickerson frequently and ask Dickerson to look after him, for "we both know that young men are sometimes in want of a friend." Lewis gave Marks $60 and asked Dickerson to advance him $200, which he would repay when he received his salary on January 15th, as governor for the last 3 months of the year. Some money was coming in from subscribers to the journals. A William Woods, perhaps a local Baptist minister, or perhaps the Woods who was a surveyor of Albemarle County, was his agent. Woods received the $31 total from a number of local residents. Other monies came in by mail. Lewis had written Clark about one of his courtships. Clark had replied with a recommendation for a Miss C. Lewis had replied in cryptic fashion, "For God's sake, do not whisper my attachment to Miss Blank, or I am undone." Who Miss C and Miss Blank were, or what happened, is unknown. Lewis and Clark biographer John Bakeless speculates that perhaps they didn't meet Lewis's standards. What mere girl could approach the grace, the charm, the intelligence, and the tremendous vigor of his fascinating mother? Perhaps the girls didn't want to get into a competition with Lucy Marks. Sometime later, in Philadelphia, Lewis had what he described to Dickerson as a little affair with Miss A. Blank N. R. Blank S. H. The relationship, he reported, had neither beginning nor end on her part. Per contra, on my own, it has had both. The fact is that on inquiry I found that she was previously engaged, and therefore dismissed every idea of prosecuting my pretensions in that quarter. Then there was Lewis's intense interest in Miss E. Blank B. Blank Y, which also led nowhere. In late November, Lewis and his younger brother Reuben, who was planning to join the governor in St. Louis and get into the fur trade, went to Fincastle, where they stayed in the home of Clark's father-in-law, George Hancock. There, the brothers met Letitia and Elizabeth Breckinridge, daughters of General James Breckinridge. Reuben wrote to the family back home, "We had the pleasure of seeing the accomplished and beautiful Miss Letitia Breckinridge, one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen, both as to form and features. I should like to have her as a sister." Lewis was smitten at first sight. He expressed his intention of making a formal call on Letitia, but he evidently came on too strong. Miss Breckinridge heard of the governor's intention of courting her, and concluded that if she remained, it would look too much like a challenge. She accompanied her father on a trip to Richmond. Reuben reported that, "Unfortunately for His Excellency, Lewis, she left the neighborhood 2 days after our arrival, so that he was disappointed in his design of addressing her." Letitia's sister Elizabeth was still in Fincastle, but Lewis had been so taken with Letitia that he was diffident about approaching her. Sometime later, he wrote to a friend from his early army career, "I consider Miss Elizabeth Breckinridge a charming girl, but such was my passion for her sister that my soul revolts at the idea of attempting to make her my wife, and I shall not consequently travel that road in quest of matrimony." Whether he courted other young women in Ivy and Fincastle is unknown. Indeed, what he did, even where he lived for that winter of 1807-8, is unknown. For the most part, the 8 months between Lewis's departure from Philadelphia and his arrival in St. Louis were a lost period in his life. The only thing productive he did was begin work on a major paper recommending a basic Indian policy for Louisiana, which took him over a year to finish. He courted without success. He took care of some family business. Otherwise, he apparently did nothing at all. He makes no appearance in Jefferson's extensive, often chatty correspondence. William Clark made no mention of him. Was he drinking to excess? Was he depressed? What caused his courtships to fail? He had the journals with him, but he prepared not one line for the printer, made no arrangements for an editor. He had promised Jefferson he would set out for St. Louis in mid-July 1807 to take up his duties and earn his salary, but he didn't actually do so until the late winter of 1808. He didn't even ask for reports from Secretary and Acting Governor Bates on the situation in St. Louis. Any analysis of his lethargy is speculative. Some that have been offered include being unlucky in love or suffering from a manic depressive psychosis, alcoholism, malaria, or some other physical illness. My own guess is that some combination of these explanations, especially the first three, was among the causes, but there were others that exacerbated the depressions and the drinking, and perhaps his inability to find a wife. He had had more success than was good for him. At age 34, he missed the adulation he had become accustomed to receiving. Of course, he was honored at home in Charlottesville and Ivy, but that was hardly like being celebrated in Washington and Philadelphia. He had had too independent a command too early in life. Not that he had botched it, obviously he was a genuinely great company commander, but he had become accustomed to instant obedience from a platoon-sized force of the best riflemen, woodsmen, and soldiers in the United States. He no longer held that command. He certainly couldn't get his slaves to respond to his commands as quickly or efficiently as the men of the Corps of Discovery had done, and beyond his slaves, he had no one to order about. In modern popular psychology, he might be said to have been suffering from postpartum depression. Malaria, alcohol, and a predisposition to melancholy would have made it more severe. His unlikely